This podcast is powered by The Plug.
Who's gonna get it out? It ain't even mine to hold, man. Tech ready. Tech that. All we got is our word.
Hello, this is Marisol Solar Therilocker, psychotherapist and consultant. And this is the Resilience and Resistance Podcast, a podcast about successful Black, Indigenous women of color who have overcome trauma and become resilient.
Hi, Tron.
Hi, Marisol.
Thanks so much for being a guest on this podcast.
Of course.
I so appreciate you.
Of course.
I was trying to think back to when I met you and how I met you, and it was at the Fabric Lab.
I know.
And that's way back in the day. So it was 2004.
Yep.
So 16 years ago.
I know. I mean, it feels, I don't know why it feels longer than that. Maybe just because we've done so much from then to now and how much we've evolved and learned and failed at and
all of it.
Yeah. You know, we had more kids during that time.
Totally did.
New jobs and, you know, just all that crazy stuff. But I can't, that's how long we've known each other.
Yeah, 16 years.
Yeah.
And I was trying to remember how I got to the Fabric Lab, and I remembered. And so I'm hoping that I'm remembering correctly. So I read about it in the Westward.
Yep.
And I think you told a story to the Westward about how you were somewhere, maybe it was California, and someone famous had like asked to take the hat off of your head or something.
That happened. Where it was probably one of our first trips. I don't know if it was California. I forgot where it was, but you know, I was buying things and adding whatever to them, right? Either Josh would spray paint something or I'd add some buttons or some weird brooch or, you know, just make kind of cool things that, which we see a lot of it now, you know what I mean? Yeah. Especially with sites like Etsy and stuff. You see a lot of that now. So I feel like I was doing kind of that stuff already back then. And I think a lot of artists that were trying to find their creativity. And then I started doing that into clothes. And then Josh and I started working on like going to the thrift store. And I think that hat was a thrift store hat. And then I found through a jewelry case all the brooches and weird necklaces. I'd break them apart and sew them onto things. And then we started doing that on like men's coat jackets.
Yeah.
And he'd screen print and I'd sew buttons on all cool, kind of almost collage style. And then I think we really got into that. And then people wanted to buy it. Just like this guy was like, I want to buy your hat. And I was like, $50. And he just handed me $50. I was like, okay. And, you know, and I think that kind of just, you know, spark that, keep making stuff. And at that time, I was pregnant with Quinn at the time, I think, and I already had Noah. So I was just trying to, you know, do stuff while I was home with the kids.
Yeah.
Or with one kid and pregnant with the other. And Josh was working night shifts and late, working all the time. And I was just trying to keep myself busy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it all started. And then, which is funny, I hate to say this word, but then I went into Buffalo Exchange.
Yeah.
And met one of my good friends now, to this day, Trisha Hoke, who was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Cause she also made clothes at the time working there. She obviously doesn't work there anymore for a long time now, but she's like, we'll take whatever you're making. And at that time, we were getting mixed in with all the vintage and stuff at Buffalo Exchange. And that kind of sparked me. I was like, why isn't there a store?
Yeah.
That sells only like locally made goods, art, jewelry, whatever. And then that's kind of how Fabric Lab, and Josh actually came up with the name, and I just kind of spun off of that. So we did a lot of collaboration at night. Even he worked all day, but all day I would be like doing stuff. Like he'd have some ideas and I'd kind of combine those things, and then he'd come home and see all the products that I would be making or anything like that, or ideas. So a lot of that was happening at night. Which I feel like that's where the best ideas are usually, or creativity kind of sparks. So that's kind of, and then we had the opportunity to open a basement on Colfax.
Yes, I remember that basement.
Yep, and everyone does. It's so fun. Like, I met you in the base of Colfax, and it's always so fun. And then people who don't know, who are around, they're like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, and, you know, back then, as you know, it was not a place to be in the basement of East Colfax. But that was when it was starting to, like, you know, kind of, as you know, it was rebuilding and growth, and more families were moving in that part of was St. Paul and Colfax. And so And then, you know, obviously we were getting picked up because there was not really a true store. Other than Lori Lynx Murphy, which is still a friend to this day, she was more of an art gallery and had some small goods, but we kind of took all the clothes and fashion and kind of made that our thing. And, you know, art was kind of like we did on another side, where she was the opposite. So so that was cool to have just those two at that time.
Yeah.
But at that time, we had Revoluciones and all these cool galleries, if you remember. So
I do remember.
You know, so it was a really cool creative time back then.
Yeah.
And that kind of, we created friendships.
Yeah.
And we took a lot of those friendships with us. I mean, at the same time, we met not so great people. You know what I mean? I feel like that's just anyone's journey.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how that started. And then I opened a cupcake shop.
Yeah, I remember the cupcake shop.
Which also became a cupcake cereal. And that was very successful, you know. But and then I got pregnant with my youngest and, you know, and just fun, you know, stuff with partnerships. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any better back then.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, we ended that partnership. And the person who, you know, was my partner took over the cupcake shop. And I kind of just took a break.
Yeah.
And during that break, obviously I was pregnant and I had my son. I kind of took a little hiatus. And then I ended up working for eBags for a couple years. Oh, I think I lasted 2 years. I think Josh gave me like 6 months or something because, you know, I've never been in an office setting. And I worked there for a little, and I learned a lot. I met a lot of great people who are still friends to me. We're still friends and communicate till this day, which is awesome. And then during that time, I was like, okay, maybe this is not for me. And then we ended up opening a gallery again outside of my, we ended up moving on right down the street here where Bar Fausto was. That was our house for a little bit. So I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, I do remember that.
So we ended up doing a gallery like on the weekends part time, which were really successful, called Superordinary.
Oh, yeah.
And then we ended up getting partners there. And we opened up the Source.
Yeah.
I'm trying to like go down the timeline. And then it got bigger. And then we opened in there for a while. And then I, and I had the idea when I was pregnant with my youngest for Base Coat during that time, you know, before that actually. And then it kind of almost like sparked again when I was like, oh, I want to get a mani and pedi. And I grew up in the industry. I think for me, I was always trying to run away from it, which is funny because I grew up with it. I mean, my mom is still a nail artist. My sister, aunts and uncles still own salons here in Colorado and family all over the country. And so, you know, I think when you grow up and you're kind of growing that world and you kind of have that stigma of like mostly Vietnamese, it's a very Vietnamese part of our culture, nail salons, you know, and there's a whole history behind it after the war. So it's just something like everyone did. And I was just like, I don't want to do that. You know, I was kind of like turned my nose up and was a little brat about it, you know, and it's funny how it came full circle. And here I am. And now I own Base Coat, which is a non-toxic nail salon. I'm not reinventing the world or the service, but I'm creating a better, healthier world for it. You know what I mean? And I think it's still new to a lot of, especially the small mom pop shops. But they're also starting to understand how toxic the chemicals they have been using for decades. And they're understanding that. And I think customers obviously are looking for more better options when they come, you know what I mean, with food and everything else, right? And beauty. So it's been great. You know, it's definitely like we were talking before, every day is a new adventure, I like to call it. I'm like, oh, what's today's adventure? And especially during a pandemic, owning a nail salon that's very high touch. You can't be 6 feet away. It's not like shopping in a store or eating at a restaurant, like take your order and then you leave. Like, you know, the server leaves and just you enjoy your meal. It's like, no, we're touching hands and feet. And we're like this far away from each other. But I feel like it really got me out of my complacent world for a little bit because I was kind of stuck in the very, someone's like, you weren't distracted, you were focused. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. I was like, so I guess I was really focused and really ignoring the things that were happening around me. Like Black Lives Movement and all these things that really were important to me. And then I was like, okay, it did really, like everyone, I think right now, it woke everyone up. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all been home mm-hmm. and really think about how messed up this pandemic has shown its true colors mm-hmm. when it comes to inequities and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're just like, ugh, this is really bad.
Yeah.
And we all have just been blindly walking through it just to get through another day.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, we can't live like this forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And especially for our children.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want my kids to live like we've just kind of like work. And that was kind of the way we were conditioned for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
To ignore all those things.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious. So I think so many things in terms of you know, snubbing the nail industry and feeling like that's such a cultural thing and there's such a long history and there's so many things related mm-hmm. to that probably felt very difficult to embrace for you.
Okay, so as you know, in the Vietnamese culture, it's a huge part of many kids' lives my age now, I guess, or yeah. people's lives my age now. We, after the war, you know, Tippi Hedren helped a bunch of women refugees and and trying to find a vocational trade for a lot of them. And the one thing, I think one of the, you know, Vietnamese refugee women, a lot of them were teachers before they came here. They had careers and all these things before they came here. And a lot of them were wives of generals and things like that. So they had asylum. And so when they came over, they didn't speak the language and all these things that obviously immigrants face every day. And especially during a war, you know, leaving a war-torn country. And so they came here and she, you know, was like, well, I can't find anything for you. And of course, one of the women were like, oh, I like how your nails are done. And that's kind of how it kind of all started.
Wow.
And she brought in our own manicurist and someone from another beauty school that was in California at the time and helped all these women learn how to paint nails, you yeah. know what I mean? And polish and manicures and pedicures. And at that time, manicures and pedicures were only for well-off people. So, you know, everyday people really couldn't afford. And back then, actually, manicures and pedicures cost like $100.
Yeah.
It wasn't cheap back then for anyone. So it wasn't really a luxury for normal everyday people. But after a few years after the war, a lot of the refugees, you know, took on to that, started, you know, getting, you know, the education, the vocational training on doing nails, and a lot of them ended up opening. But one particular story was two women who met at a nail salon. One was a black woman, one was an Asian woman, and they opened a nail salon called Man Trap in California. So that's kind of like the history, and those are things I'm learning now. And I think when I was growing up, no one really told us the story. We just assumed like, oh, they're washing people's feet and hands, and I don't want to do that. And I think our parents also didn't want that for us.
Yeah,
they were doing it so that we can have a better life, just like any immigrants, you know, doing cleaning houses and working at the farms or doing the essential jobs, right? And that's kind of what they felt as doing a manicure and pedicure was helping their children not be in that industry. So we were pushed away from that. And a lot of my friends or, you know, Vietnamese friends also were pushed away from that. And almost like a stigma that was created within like, oh, I don't want to do nails. Like, you know, they kind of almost, you know, and also dealing with racism at that time too.
Yeah,
so we're not
yeah.
going to ignore that. So a lot of them were like, I don't want to be treated like that. Like how my mom and dad are treated.
Yeah.
So I think everyone just, it was a lot of that happening. And and I saw that too, and I was like, I don't want to be treated like crap.
Yeah.
I'm scrubbing your feet. I shouldn't be treated like that.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, why is it okay for my mom? You know? Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay. And I, you know, I did. I ran away from it. I was just like, I don't want to do that. And I got into fashion and all these things, being creative, which I feel like I always was. And that's kind of how the Vietnamese culture has really taken over that industry.
Yeah.
And me growing up with it, I already had that background. I grew up in it. And I was like, well, how, when, you know, that time came again after Super Ordinary, where I was like, I'm, base coat is, needs to exist in the world. How do I make it happen? And how do I make it better for the people working in the salon?
Mm-hmm.
How do I make sure they're not being exploited working in the salon? How do I educate customers to understand, like, you know, they're doing something that no one else does, just like many immigrants. But they, what's different about this industry, they pay to go to school. So I think a lot of people don't understand that either. They pay to be in customer service. They pay to clean your feet and do your nails, and that they chose that career path. You know what I mean? So I'm trying to elevate this industry where people should be standing up for themselves and really understanding that this is more than just doing nails. And I feel like the Base Co has always been that. We've always been more than a nail salon. We've always been advocates for higher pay, making sure nail workers are getting lunches, making sure employers are not exploiting. As we know, there is a lot of illegal activities, including trafficking, that happens in the nail industry. I never grew up with that or seeing that, but I heard of it. You know what I mean? And I ignored it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people would bring family and friends, they would say, from other countries, and then make them work in their nail salons.
Yeah.
But I never really understood that until the last, like, 7-8 years.
Yeah.
Where I was like, no, they are actually trafficking people to work at their salons for free.
Hmm.
And that still happens to this day. It's just a modern day of slavery, in a way. You know what I mean? So that is kind of where I kind of step in, and I work with a nonprofit in California who mostly works with Vietnamese nail salon owners who do want to do better.
Yeah.
A lot of older nail salon owners. And so I'm coming in, be like, here's my experience. I don't want to scare. A lot of them are scared because they know they're doing things illegally, like paying people under the table, not providing lunches, and reusing things, and not sanitizing things correctly. And they know they're doing that, but it all starts with also the prices of nail prices. So you guys have, I'm sure you have seen me, like, really advocate, like, a manicure shouldn't be $15.
Mm-mm.
I have broken down, even using the cheapest supplies, it comes out to still $30. Mm. But because it's so widespread, there's so many nail salons in every block, in every community in this country, so they're always competing with each other.
Yeah.
Instead of having this widespread industry pricing, you know what I mean? Yeah. A standard.
Yeah.
And we never really had that. And that's something I'm working on right now with Base Co. Like, every nail salon, you should start your prices at $30.
Mm-hmm.
What happens from there on? But at $30, you can provide for your employees a living wage. You can buy better supplies that are not toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And all these things that becomes a domino effect.
Yeah.
Because when lower wages happen, that's when exploitation happens.
Yeah.
Because they're always finding a shortcut, trying a way to screw an employee or a guest and all these things. And I know it's not on purpose because everyone's trying to survive. So I'm like an advocate on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm like, I know why you're doing this,
mm-hmm.
but you can't do that. But here's a better way for you
mm-hmm.
to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I've been doing a lot of. And I want to have that here in Colorado. It's big in California and New York right now. There's
mm-hmm.
two nail salon associations that are advocates for nail salon workers in both those states. But we don't have one for Colorado just because, of course, we're not as big as those two states.
Right.
And the exploitation is really happening very apparently in those two states
mm-hmm.
as well. So,
So
it's just almost like educating. It's hard because a lot of Vietnamese people are very traditional and they want to do things their way and they're very stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I get a lot of that, but I'm also like, but I can try to help you make more money.
Yeah.
And then you have no turnover rate and you have happier employees. Here are how you do it. And I'm not perfect. Base Co is not perfect. And I tell my employees that on a regular basis. I tell myself that. And people are like, I love Base Co. I'm like, I appreciate you love Base Co, but I am still working behind the scenes every day to make it better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's like a new thing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of nail salons are looking at us for that.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of pressure on my shoulders of always like being that good role model. But at the same time, I don't know what I'm doing because
mm-hmm.
every day, just like we were talking before, I'm learning
yeah.
a freaking new thing. Like, oh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
And I have to spend almost a week, sometimes to a month, trying to figure out one thing
yeah.
to make not only my, you know, employees' lives better, but my guests' lives, you know, their experience better.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we make money at the end of the day?
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you or your company are looking to jump into the podcast world, now is the time. The Plug Agency is here to connect you to the full power of podcasting. You just record and leave the rest to us. The people are listening and want to hear from you. Theplug-agency.com That's theplug-agency.com. Click the link in the episode description for an exclusive offer.
I mean, it seems like, and I think one of the reasons that I thought it would be really important to bring you on is that you, just knowing part of your story, mm-hmm. and part of your story is that you were a teenage mom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now being on the other side of that, mm-hmm. having a family,
and
having
teenagers.
Had, and teenagers,
yep.
and having created
yeah.
and owned and cultivated many successful businesses.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I would love for you to speak to that.
Well, yeah, like I, you know, in the beginning I was talking about how the fabric lab. At that time I was, when I started that business, I was 19.
Mm.
I had Noah when I was 17. So I came from a, not the best of childhoods, and I still have a strained relationship with my parents. So I've been on my own technically since I was 15.
Yeah.
And I was house hopping for a while, but there were some nights where I literally was homeless.
Wow.
And would sleep wherever just because home was so bad. So I was being physically abused, and something I really haven't talked to my parents about, I was also sexually abused by my cousins who lived in the home with us for a while.
Oh, John.
So, you know, I used to cry about it a lot, but now I'm just like, okay, that's what kind of makes me really like push.
Yeah.
Anytime there is a situation, I'm like, I've had it worse than this.
Yeah.
I can figure this out.
Yep.
Yeah. So I don't mean to make you cry. And my kids know this story, and you know, Josh obviously does too. And I've talked about it quite a bit. I think I'm more comfortable with it now,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
So 15, I was already felt like a broken kid, you
yeah.
know, something was obviously already wrong with me.
Yeah.
And then having an abusive parent, my mom was more mental, my dad was more physical.
Yeah.
And then having this secret,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It kind of just was like, I don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, I didn't give a shit about anything. I was like, I don't want to go to school. You know, you kind of feel like a worthless, I mean, that's how I felt. It's like, who's going to want me?
Yeah.
Or want anything to do with me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I went to school every day because that was my safe spot. That was, so when this pandemic happened, that kind of hit hard for me for sure.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about all the kids that go to school to feel safe. And I'm thankful my kids really have not gone through what, you know, even Josh has gone through some traumatic things as well. And that was our, you know, so I went to school because that's where I was loved by friends and cared for by teachers.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm such a huge advocate for teachers. And you'll
yeah.
see that. Like, I
yeah.
will walk in front of a bus for a teacher. Just because the teachers that I had in my life, especially a counselor who I'm friends with now, saved my life, really.
Yeah.
They really took care of me. And especially when I met Josh. And that's when I felt like, okay, I am not. I feel loved. And Josh was the first one to ever make me feel that way.
Yeah.
And obviously we've been married, I don't know, 25 years.
That was like a long time.
Yeah. So
yeah.
you know, so I feel like Josh and the teachers I had and the counselors I had and the social worker, I wish I can find her name, and I keep trying to, who really advocated for me when I got pregnant with Noah. So there's so much stuff happening. But, you know, I've been technically on my own since I was 15.
Yeah.
And the last time I was home was when my dad did really beat me really bad, to the point where, you know, these bruises stayed on my body for at least 2 years. My dad was put in jail. But I wasn't taken away. I ended up being put in the home next to my parents' house.
Mm.
So being next to your abuser still, even, you know,
yeah.
that's why I get upset about the system a lot, because mm-hmm. I feel like the system failed me and my dad.
Yeah.
Instead of getting him the help he needed, right? He didn't understand why in America you can't hit your kids.
Yeah.
And I do remember a police officer saying, you can't do that here.
Yeah.
And my dad just really not clicking. And I just was listening in a jail cell, them talked. And then I was put in a jail cell. And my dad was across, or I don't know where he was, but I just hear the police officer that day, just that night, talking to him, like, you can't hit your kids, man. Like, you, I know you did that in Vietnam and you probably grew up that way. So there was a police officer that tried, but the system definitely failed both of us. And so I advocate for so many things just because of my own trauma and a lot of my own personal experiences. And I try to be very voiceful about them. Like, you know, yeah, I was sexually assaulted. Yes, I was, physically abused. And yes, the system failed me, but they also failed my dad at the same time. Yeah. So it's like, so I think a lot of those experiences and having a supportive teacher and a very supportive husband really showed me like there could be good and there could be positive and you can have a beautiful life, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But when you're in the midst of it, mm-hmm. you don't think that. Mm-mm. You're just trying to survive another day. And I feel like that is a lot of kids right now, or kids of, you know, people of color, immigrants and all those things, you know what I mean, are dealing with that right now. So
Yeah. That's so powerful, Tran. And I think that for you, it was having that supportive environment, having those people come around you and see you and your talent and all the things that were helpful motivators for you to keep going forward.
I think all of us believe things happen for a reason and people come in and out of your lives for a reason, right? But that time was a really dark time where contemplating suicide and all these things that you're just like, I have nowhere to live. I have no money. I have no support. I can't go home.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like a checklist of things. You're just like, what am I doing? Why am I here? That was definitely trauma I still deal with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like anyone. Like, your trauma doesn't go away. And I feel like people say, well, you know, you can work for it to go away. But I believe you have to still have that to move on sometimes. Mm. And I feel like that's kind of what happened to me. Just like if I am having a bad day or there's a bad time happening in one of my businesses, I know how to get out of it. I know what low is. I know when there's no food or barely paying my rent. So when people are especially during this pandemic, they're like, I don't know how I'm going to pay my rent. And I'm like, oh, I know. Because I've been on the bottom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I know how to be a penny pincher. And I know, like, how to, like, allocate things or cut things off or be financially, like, stable. So I think that's why Basecoat technically survived this pandemic so far.
Yeah.
And also having help from my business partner, Sarah, who's also awesome and a huge part. But I think we just really figured out, like, where we need to, like, you know, really be important in the business. Just like at you at home, like, what bill's more important right now? This is all the money I have.
Yep.
So what needs to go to first? So like during the pandemic, pay our employees because we're going to need them later. You know what I mean? I could figure out a payment plan on my electrical and my rent. You know what I mean? Like, those are things I could figure out later.
Yeah.
That's what we did.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's so important. I think that's so valuable because I talk a lot about this in terms of how women of color adapt in different ways that actually become so useful in both our professional and personal lives.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes we see those as deficits, right? Like all these things that I had to overcome or became obstacles in my path were hindrances for me to move forward. But in a lot of ways, those become tools that you can use later.
And I definitely use those tools, especially during this pandemic, and especially during the rough times we had for Basecoat. Like Basecoat, I think people see the success of all the cool things that has happened to Basecoat, but they don't see all the stuff behind the times where we were negative in the bank account and payroll was coming out.
Yeah.
Or we were barely making rent and I'm trying to be like, I don't have money for rent. What can we do? You know what I mean? And thankfully I have some landlords that were really awesome, especially during the pandemic. Some not, some amazing. And I figured how to negotiate those things. You know, I didn't ask for anyone's help. And that's, I think too, with women of color or who have lived this trauma, we're like, we're just going to do it. And we're going to figure it out. And the worst thing someone's going to say is no. And we're not going to make that, like, we're not going to sulk about it. We're like, okay, then what else can we do? You know what I mean? I feel like my kind of, like, motto at home was, like, well, there's a plan A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there is no ending to a plan. And there's no way you can predict what's going to happen. And,
yeah.
So I feel like that's why I think Base Coat was so successful.
Yeah.
Because I did have businesses before, but they weren't perfect. And some of them did fail. And they failed because I didn't, you know something.
Yeah.
Or they didn't try hard at something, and I kind of just gave up. And I realized, like, you know what? I didn't. And even Josh is like, no, you kept pushing for Base Coat for some reason. Of all the businesses we had, Base Coat was the one you were just like, nope, we got to keep going. Nope, don't sell it. There was times when I even put the business on Craigslist, like, who wants to buy this thing? And you know what I mean? Uh-huh. And I was like, I don't want it anymore. and then something would tell me to take it off Craigslist. And then Josh would be like, I don't know why, but Base Coat definitely was the thing that did stick. And mm-hmm. I think it's because of the thing I knew,
yeah.
right? I knew the industry, I knew the people, I knew the culture. I know it's not an easy job, mm-hmm. and I know it's not a job that not everyone loves, but I'm realizing, no, that's really not true.
Yeah.
They actually, you know, my employees do love their job. They mm-hmm. love the people they, work with, and the clients that come in, they become friends with. So it's not, you know, what people think what a nail salon is. And I'm changing that with being on social, being more vocal about it,
yeah.
telling people, you are our family. Yes, we have these strict policies, but please know it's to protect both of us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And know that, you know, nail salons all should be doing this.
Yeah.
Too, you know
yeah.
what I mean? I think it shouldn't just be a one way where the guest only benefits. You know, the business needs a benefit.
Too. Yeah.
So just like a lot of these things I grew up with in inequities when I was growing up, kind of like seeing that at my parents, seeing that with myself, and then living all these experiences and traumas that, you know, I hate always like cliche, like it did make me stronger, mm-hmm. but it also made me see through things when things got bad.
Yeah.
Like I feel like sometimes people get this block and they're just stop. And for me, I was like, I know there's a block there, but I know I can get through it. And I just need to figure out how to do it. Just give me a day, you know, just to kind of sit and think about it.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of how my life has been, like living day by day, but also to the point where it's like, I do have a plan.
Yeah.
And I can figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so curious because it seems as though just the trauma that you experienced in childhood became a driver for you mm-hmm. and continues to fuel a lot of what you do. Did you ever find there were times when it was hard to accept the success that you were encountering?
Oh, yeah. What yeah. is that saying? Is it that? What is that? I just forget. Imposter syndrome?
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I feel like I still do have that. You know what I mean? Like I don't deserve to be at Nordstrom's. I don't deserve all these amazing employees I have that support me on a regular. I don't deserve to have this husband and these awesome kids, and that I kind of shouldn't talk about and like gloat about it, or you know, and have pride for these things. But then sometimes, you know, and I think everyone has that, right? Everyone gets in those, you know, and that's everyone's right to have these up and downs. That's the, you know, that's makes you human. Mm-hmm. And I definitely get like that sometimes, you know, but yeah. then I realize like all the crazy shit I've already been through and how it got me to here. It does. Then I like get out of it, snap out of it, and I get out of it. And Josh is actually really good about like, you need to snap out of whatever shit you're going through right now, because I love you. Your kids love you. Your staff love you, and you love them, and they see that. And, just that imposter syndrome always kicks in, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And even now when people are like, Tron, you're in Nordstrom's, and I'm like, I don't even know what that means, because I've been working behind the scenes to make it happen. And it's funny, I've become really good friends with a lot of people that work at Nordstrom's, and I even think that's weird. I was like, what is happening? And I never thought our brand, like Base Coat, you know, would even get noticed, you know? But I think they see like the actual thing that we've always been more than a nail salon. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Because nail yeah. salons can be, it's a very vain industry. But then this whole self-care movement came around and it got even bigger. And then the clean beauty world got bigger. And then we were the combo of all of them. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely have, I feel like I have that sometimes. And I think people see that I am, you know, I'm not the typical boss. I'm part of every day of the business. And I learned a really bad mistake from that when I had Base Coat, for sure, when I kind of left it to other people to run it. And it lost its way,
yeah.
for sure. And now I kind of learned from that, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah. So I also wonder, I mean, you obviously are a mom, business owner, and a mom of four. Mm-hmm. I say mom, but I meant to say mom of four.
Right.
What has been, how have you been able to manage it all? What is the thing that has helped you?
I think for me, it was just having Josh, a partner that really was supportive, and I was supportive of him. And it's hard. I feel very privileged to say that, because not everyone has that who wants to open a business. You know what I mean? And I think even to being a young parent, opening a business, thrown with that was super difficult. You know, we were just trying to just make rent, but I was just so anti, not working, but working for other people for some reason, where I was like, I know I'm meant to do more than this.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Josh was like, well, I want you to do this. I'll just work. You know what I mean? So he did, a lot of sacrifices happened.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I feel like a lot did fall upon Josh. You know, and that, again, like those are days when I get sad, where I'm like, man, he really sacrificed a lot for me to follow my dream. So having that partner really helping, like, not only follow the dream, but also take care of the kids. You know, we had four kids. And owning my own business, too, I got to take them with me. You know what I mean? I didn't care if people were like, why is your kid at the me? I'm like, well, do you want to find a babysitter? Because I can't find one. And my husband's working right now.
Yeah.
Do you want to have this meeting or not? Mm-hmm. You know, this is before virtual and all this stuff. You know what I mean? Which I was like, geez, this would have been really nice a long time ago, where parents could work from home. You know what I mean? Even though it's still kind of a disaster, and you have kids walking in and trying to cook dinner and all that stuff. You know what I mean? That was kind of our life back then, you know, and we just tag team it. But I still kind of trying to figure out, like, how would I talk to someone that doesn't have that support?
Yeah.
And I really believe it's just, you know, pick and choose what you feel like is important for you to do right now, and still obviously spend time with your kids. And finding even support, family doesn't have to be family, you know, your support doesn't have to be actual blood family, you know, having that. I think now with the virtual world and social media, you can find those people that can support you either online, where they can be your, like, on your sideline rooting for you, or, you know, finding them in your neighborhoods that can help in any way they can, you know what I mean? But it's hard when you want to do what you love, but you can't really afford a babysitter or all these things to help you kind of get to there. So it's like, I still kind of struggle with how to help women. Like, I've had that question before, and I really struggle with it, because I don't know the answer. You know what I mean? Because I've never had that true experience yet.
Yeah.
Obviously not ever, but I mean, I don't know. That's a hard one.
Yeah. But with supportive partner and just doing it.
Yeah. And that, you know, there are sacrifices, and I've sacrificed a lot too, but now I think it's kind of cool too. Josh, you know, he was ready, when he was ready to leave his agency job, and I was like, just do it. Mm-hmm. Even though he was scared to do it, and we were both scared, because he was making like six figures. Mm-hmm. He was the top of his game in the agency and branding world, and he just couldn't do it anymore, because he is a true family man. There was times where we wouldn't see, I'd go visit him at 1 o'clock in the office, and he'd be like, head down on the table sleeping.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, I can't live like this. I want to see my family. I love my family, actually, and I don't want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so now we're just really good at tag teaming now, you know, and there's some days where, and we've kind of had that conversations, like, there, when I was traveling a lot for Nordstrom, he knew that was my time, and he stepped in. And then when he was traveling a lot before I had, you know, we had all the little guys, before I had base coat, it was me. So it balanced out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was gone like every day for almost 2 years. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, but you know, with him, the kids were older. We have a freaking giant child. He's 21 now, you know, and so they were all helpful, and he, you know, they would pitch in and drive. So I think seeing how busy our family are, like now having these older kids and how busy Josh and I, has been really cool to see, and still be technically young parents, you know what I mean? And be like, oh, we can just leave you at home now and just go do whatever we want. And we didn't have that, you know, as young parents. We were like, barely could afford a sitter, so we never really went out as much. And now I think you see we're always out to dinner. I'm like, because we never got to do any of that. You know, it's the opposite now. Like, when people were dating and married, they got to go on vacations and all that, and I'd be like, I'll never get that. You know what I mean? And now we're there.
And now you do.
Yeah, now you do. Just having that a support or finding support. And it doesn't have to be family.
Yeah.
Really, really, and that's easy for me to say, but I feel like it's a lot easier now with social media and Facebook and all these things, finding those groups that are like you, you know, and have the same ethos and same being a single parent and wanting to open a business or doing something they love. It doesn't even have to be like, you know, or being a volunteer or all those things, you know, and outside of, you know, and finding that one thing that they love.
So going back to childhood trauma, and, you know, I actually recently had a conversation with a friend about how difficult it is to for people to be able to talk openly about experiencing or surviving childhood sexual abuse. And I'm curious for you, like, obviously, I think it's in communities of color, it's very there's strong stigma, right? A lot of silence. I think this is true generally in most communities.
All those things,
but I think particularly in communities of color, there's it's very difficult to be able to break the silence. And I'm curious to know for you, what was it that helped you be able to talk openly about that?
That didn't actually start until, I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was a story I read, and it was about another woman that was an entrepreneur who had gone through almost a very similar situation. I don't know what triggered me to start talking about it. I think when Women Rights Act, you know, when the women rights protests and things were happening and people were talking more about sexuality and how being a woman doesn't give you a right to, like, I think when I got into more social justice, I started to realize, like, I don't know why I'm ashamed to talk about this.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it did make me a stronger person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It made me realize, like, I shouldn't be ashamed of it. And especially, like you said, in communities of color, you know, it's almost like this shame because it's almost blamed on you for causing it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's true. Like, you know, I have friends who were sexually abused, but the boyfriend sexually abused them, but the mom blamed her for it. You know what I mean? So there was a lot of that. And they're like being blamed for something like that. And I never talked to my parents openly about it because I think that's what would happen.
Yeah.
And so I think when I started talking openly, I never went to a therapist or anything for it. I think when I started talking to Josh more about it, I felt more comfortable, and he was very, I don't know, there was something on his face where he was just like, oh my God, first, but then it was like, almost like this relief, kind of understanding when I do have these kind of emotional breakdowns.
Yeah.
And now I can like openly talk to him about it, you know what I mean? And be like, this happened to me. So if I get skittish, or there's sometimes when I see, you know, like right now we're hearing about, you know, more child sex trafficking. That's very triggering.
Yeah.
And that very triggered to me.
Yeah.
For sure. You know what I mean? So, so I talk about that more openly. I think when you share stories, especially of women of color, I think more people will share their trauma. And then you have women of color owned businesses.
Yeah.
And seeing how that has helped me talk about it publicly, and maybe that would help someone else be like, you know what, I need to talk about it publicly and I shouldn't be ashamed of it.
Yeah.
And this is how I'm handling it. And I kind of put my energy in my business that way.
Yeah.
Like when I do have those times where I am kind of triggered by it and I'm just like, okay, I need to focus on something more positive. So I started turning it around, doing like, okay, I'm going to do this project.
Mm-hmm.
And I get very focused on that project, which kind of takes that trauma away for a little bit.
You know?
And then also having my own kids and knowing that I protect them. You know, I'm not the best parent for sure. Just like all of us, we're not perfect parents, but I know I will always protect them and also have these honest conversations with them.
Yeah.
So they do know that I was sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
And, as a child and physically abused by their grandparents. Those are all conversations I had with them.
Yeah.
And so when they have these like moments where they're being, you know, teenagers, I'm like, you know, I don't try to throw in their face like, you don't even know how I got it or your dad got it. We got a lot worse. We're just like, hey, we know you're going through this, but please know we love you and we would never hurt you. And we're here for you and you can talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a really close family.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think just having, and they know, you know what I mean? Instead of bottling it up and being not having those family secrets, I feel like a lot of people do.
Yeah.
And they're scared to share it. So I feel like that's how I handled my trauma for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I really do believe that. I truly believe that the more people are able to tell their stories, that it really frees other people to share. Yeah. And then it continues to break that.
And it breaks the cycle.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really do. Yeah. I believe, and I think, I don't know where I read it, and I wish I could find that article. I know I saved it somewhere, but... You know, she was just talking about like how it just like freed her, and I was like, I should probably try that and be more open about it. Mm-hmm. And ever since I do that, I get these really amazing messages, you know, like, you know, thank you. You know, I was sexually assaulted too as a child, and, you know, I'm dealing with, like, everyone's dealing with something. And yeah. That's why I always feel like try to be patient with everyone, because you don't know what they're going through.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people are just having a bad day. And, you know, sometimes I forget, like, this person's just sad, and this is how they react.
Yeah.
And I get those days too, where I like just take it out on Josh or the kids, and I'm just like, I need to not do that.
Yeah.
I need to stop that cycle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
For sure.
Yeah. I'm trying to be better at it. I mean, those are some areas I still have to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's going to be a forever ongoing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, podcast is about overcoming trauma. Uh-huh. And becoming resilient. So when you think about resilience, what comes up for you?
I think for resilience, for anyone going through trauma, is not blame it on yourself.
Yeah.
And don't blame it on others. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that's, and then trying to find a way to, I don't know, I guess talk to people about it and really show that you can get through it, you know what I mean? And it's not going to be easy. You're going to cry and be angry, and you just have to keep taking that step. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? I feel like that for me has been, there's been times where I didn't want to get out of bed, or, you know, sometimes, like I said, when something triggers me and I'm just like, okay, I just don't want to do today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no, you know what I mean? There's so many people that depend on you mm-hmm. outside of your brain, your emotions, your body. Like, you have kids, you have these employees that are relying on you, you have a husband that, you know, adores and loves you, or your partner, whoever, and you being mad at yourself and sad, which is okay. You know, I mean, I always tell people, like, you are okay to be sad, and you're okay to be mad, and that's your every right as a human, but there's a moment where you can't blame others for it, and I feel like that's what happens to a lot of people that have gone through trauma. Blaming others or their self, and it's like, you didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
I always try to remind myself, like, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't deserve to be physically and sexually abused. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was a victim.
Yeah.
And I think people forget that, and it's like, let's not be the victim. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, and that's easy for me to say, but that was many years of me saying I was a victim and being mad about it and, like, you know, sad about it and trying to, like, make everyone else feel sorry for me, you know what I mean? And it's like, no, I don't want people to feel sorry for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want people to understand that I did go through this, but look where I am now, but there's a lot of work to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still a lot of work for me to be done to go over trauma and be this resilient person, I feel like. And I think I've gotten even more resilient during this pandemic, taking all those traumas, like I said, and all those experiences, and really applying that to survive a pandemic that no one knew we were going to go through.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Being able to quickly adjust.
Yes.
In those
and
moments.
I think a lot
yeah.
of people, small business, really struggle with that, where I was just like, I'm not going to wait for permission.
Yeah.
I'm not going to wait for people to come handhold, help me through this. I was like, I have people that rely on me. I need to keep this business alive. And I have gone through this before.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, like, I've had my electricity shut off. Well, it's okay. I didn't die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I was just like, okay, well, we'll figure that out later. You know what I mean? Like, we can still run our business this way, or we don't have internet, and all these things that, you know, you really just, I think people take for granted the little things like that. You know what I mean? That it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And you'll be fine.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on this podcast. Who would have thought 16 years later we'd be doing this?
Oh, it was nice. And I wish I could keep talking to you.
I know. We're going to have you back.
Okay.
And thanks again. I can't wait to talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Yeah. For my soul, y'all. Yeah. For your soul, y'all.
ain't a theory, really. This ain't something that I made up. I like to believe it's not fucking selfish.
I'm Marisol Solar Thurlacher. As a trauma expert who's worked in the field for almost 20 years, I'm transitioning from clinical practice to offering workshops, training, and coaching to mid-sized companies, organizations, and nonprofits. I partner with companies and organizations who are interested in building the resilience of their staff and empowering them regarding their mental health and well-being. If this is you, reach out to me so we can start a conversation about how I can help. If you know someone who might be interested, feel free to pass along this information. You can find more at my website, and the link can be found in the show notes. Again, as always, thank you so much for listening.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.